Good evening. My name is Jean Swihart. In 1972, well, 71 really, I started on what turned out to be a nine-month backpacking trip across Southeast Asia and East Africa. So many people have asked me, why did you go? They think I was with the Mission Board or Lutheran World Relief or something important like that. I'd like to explain, I was and still am just an ordinary housewife. But once I got my family raised, I did something I had wanted to do for many years. I wanted to get to know people of different cultures, different dress, different languages, and above all, different religions. I was always particularly interested in Ethiopia because I knew from my reading and research that this was the oldest continuously practicing Christian country in the world. There has lately been some talk that, rather facetiously, someone said, after the great powers blow themselves up, the seat of Christianity will be in Africa. You do see more and more of Christian people becoming Christians in Africa in recent years than you ever have. But since Ethiopia has long been the seat of Christianity, I was very interested in getting a first-hand idea. I was most fortunate. I happened to have spent Christmas Day in the YMCA in Delhi, India, and there I met a young Ethiopian, 33 years old, who was head of the Postal Savings Department for the country, and the World Bank had sent him to India to study the practices that they had so he could work on those in his own country. He was a very interesting young man. He was married, had two children, and had never left his country before. And yet, even though he was the oldest son of his father's third wife, and he was raised in a little village, he had a place in one ear where an earring had been, he had the mark of the Tigray tribe on his forehead, and in just a comparatively few years, he had completed work in the college in Addis. He was fluent in five languages. All educated Ethiopians have learned Ge'ez, G-E-E-Z, which is the ancient language of Ethiopia, the one that all the Bibles are written in, the ones that are used in worship service, much like the Catholics used to have everything in Latin. Then, of course, being a Tigray, which is one of the tribes of Ethiopia, the Queen of Sheba was a Tigray, they are supposed to be the most intelligent people in Ethiopia. He was fluent in English, and he also was fluent in Italian. Even the teachers in the mission field told me that they have to prepare three times as much material for the Ethiopian children as they do for comparable classes in this country. Getting an education was a tremendous privilege, great sacrifice on the part of most of the families, and their minds were just like sponges. The word Ethiopian means land of light-skinned people. They were sort of a golden color, at least the Tigrays were. The further south you go in Ethiopia, the darker and the more negroid they become. The Ethiopians call themselves the African Jews, and they do have quite a Hemetic look. Emperor Haile Selassie, one of his many titles, was Lion of Judah, and he gets that from supposedly being a descendant of Solomon, King Solomon of our Bible. So we'll commence now with some of the slides that I took. I want to apologize for the quality. I had never handled a camera before. When I got on the plane, my son handed me a camera, and he said, "It's foolproof. You just point it, focus, and shoot." So I did that for 9 months before I ever knew if I had a picture or not. Emperor Selassie put all of the money of the country into Addis. He wanted to make it a showplace of Africa. He built African Hall, where they recently had a meeting of all the African heads of government. This was the very modern hospital. The only road in the entire country loops up from Addis, up north, and back around, and the Italians built that. None of the rivers have bridges over them. During the light, early rains in the spring, the heavy rains in the fall, the people are totally isolated. The Lutheran Church has a seminary in Addis, which is shared by other denominations also, Presbyterian and so on. I really take my hat off to them for making a concentrated effort to train the Ethiopians themselves to be pastors and to minister to their own people. The idea of the mission board was to work themselves out of a job in this country. This is the dormitory where the students lived. The one you saw just before is the chapel. And this is the church in Addis where most of the Western people worshiped. You saw very few Ethiopian places here, and this service was conducted in English. I might add that now, since the communist takeover, the death of Haile Selassie, many people wondered why they killed his grandson instead of his son. Well, the people in the country didn't like Selassie's son, but they were crazy about his grandson. So they didn't bother killing the son. They went down another generation. McKinney Jesus is the official Lutheran church. It had primarily Ethiopians in it. I think, as I recall, I was the only white face there. This service is conducted in the Ethiopian national language of Amharic, which is the most commonly spoken. The interior of the church, they had an organ, a piano, and a violinist playing. The women all sat on one side, and the men sat on the other. Another custom I found rather strange, when they had communion, the mothers would take the children, the little babies, up to the altar. The priest would have a long-handled silver spoon that he dipped into the wine, and he would sort of drop it into the child's mouth as the mother held it open. And then when she turned around to go back and take her seat, she put her hand over the child's mouth. I asked Tadessa why she was doing this, and he said, "That's to keep out the evil spirits." This is Tadessa and his wife, and this was the day of the big event which took place that night, and that's what happened. The third child, they asked me the names of my children. One of them was named Michael, so they named the baby Michael. Only they spelled it M-I-K-E-L. I might add, too, the Ethiopians have another Old Testament custom. The names of the grandfathers are lost. Otto is Mr. in Ethiopian Amharic. Tadessa's name was Tadessa. He was called Otto Tadessa. Then his father's name was Waldo. His grandfather's name was Miriam. So when you wanted to call him on the phone, I picked it up one day and said, "Otto Tadessa," and the man hesitated a moment and he said, "And what was the name of his father?" rather than "What is his last name?" Now, Tadessa's son, Michael, will be called Otto Michael Tedessa Waldo, and the Miriam will be dropped and lost. There's the two of them holding the new baby, and Tedessa is wearing the national garb of Ethiopia, I suppose you'd call it. It's just a long, white, hand-woven cloth that they wrap in various ways around themselves to keep warm, to keep the rain off, to carry wood in, to carry the baby in. It's a very versatile garment. The whole family is here. The little boy's name was Samson, and the girl on the right is Tedessa's sister, Genet. The Ethiopians have another strange habit, at least it was strange to me. In a family, the oldest girl is made a servant of the family. She never marries. She helps raise the younger children. When the family is raised, then she goes to the convent and is a nun, and she's allowed to beg on the steps of the church. Three of the girls whom I met, their father was an attorney there, and they wanted very much to have pen pals in this country. The native market looks like this. The Westerners in Ethiopia had a kind of pseudo-supermarket that they could go to, but this is where the natives went. And you buy your grains in 100-pound sacks like this. The major crop in Ethiopia is teff, T-E-F. It's a grain that contains all of the nutrients needed by man. They make an enormous pancake out of this grain. It's at least 3 feet across. They stack five or six on a round table. They prepare different sauces, cottage cheese, meat, so on, and it's dumped on this top pancake. And it's called injera, that's the pancake, and wat are the sauce dishes. Then you take your hand and rip off a piece of the injera, dip it in the wat, and that's how you eat. The servant comes round, and I might add, only about 5% of the Ethiopians live as well as Tedessa and his wife. The other 95%, there's a tremendous gap between the educated people with money and the average Ethiopian. You must remember, however, as in most Asian countries, particularly the Arabic countries, not to use your left hand. It should never come as high as the tabletop. The reason for this is they have very few paper goods in these countries, and there is a dearth of toilet paper. So the left hand is used for toilet purposes, and that's why you just don't use it. I had to sit on my left hand so that if I moved it, I was aware of it, because it was such an easy habit to fall into. The woman standing next to the car in white is the national woman's Ethiopian dress. I had come from Southeast Asia, India, Nepal, Burma, Thailand, where everybody had on floor-length dresses. And it was so strange to see anything that looked this modern in Ethiopia, which is a very old style of dress. In the tourist market, they sell reproductions of the paintings that are found in the hand-painted, hand-printed Bibles. And the tails you see hanging at the upper left are the tails of gnus, or wildebeest, that they cut off and use for fly whisks. Tedessa took me to a very unique church that is not Lutheran. It's one of the Ethiopian Orthodox churches, and I learned not to use the word Coptic, because Coptic is Egyptian, and at one time the Ethiopian church was under the auspices of the Coptic Egyptian church. And then when they declared their independence, they became the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and that's what they prefer to be called. Inside, it was very difficult to photograph, but the priest drew aside the drapes and showed me the murals that were on the wall beneath the drape. This is St. George and the Dragon, and they love St. George. Everywhere you go, you see pictures of him slaying the dragon both on and off his white horse. Peter, as you recall from the Bible, was crucified upside down at his own request, and this is a mural of Peter's crucifixion. We then went to the sheep market because, well, first of all, Easter in Ethiopia is a week earlier than our Easter. And after researching, and I'm not so sure but what they might be right, during Lent, all of the meat markets are closed. You can't buy a piece of meat during Lent. And then Easter Eve, the day before Easter, everyone goes to the sheep market and buys their own sheep. Tedessa tucked his in the trunk of the car, and then they take it home. The servants prepare the meat while everyone's at the church worshiping, and then at midnight you break the fast of Lent. That's the fellow we took home and were chewing on a few hours later. It was strange, I didn't get a picture of this, but they have a big fire in the yard with a huge pot hanging over it on a tripod. And Tedessa took a knife and started to cut the sheep's throat. With that, his wife's oldest sister, who was a servant in the house, threw herself between the knife and the sheep, and there was some conversation which I didn't understand, and the knife was given to another man, and he cut the throat. I asked Tedessa what had happened, and he said that the sister was afraid that he had known his wife during Lent, and if that were true, she would not be able to eat the meat of the sheep because it would not have been clean for her. After dinner, the servant, the older sister, put this little samovar on the floor, brought the coffee, the water to a boil, ground the coffee, and very carefully put it in. And then she suddenly left the room. Tedessa's wife followed her, and she came running out very quickly and asked us to come. We went to the back of the house, and there was a small room with a mat on the floor, and this woman, who had rushed, incidentally, to get out of the way of my camera, was writhing on the floor and making noises. It wasn't so much a human imitating animal sounds. These were actually the sounds of goats, of cows, of horses, very distressful. And Tedessa told me that she had become possessed by demons. So she said something to Tedessa's wife. The wife went into her bedroom and came back with a bottle of perfume. And she poured the perfume in the palm of her sister's hand, and her sister put her hand to her mouth and drank it. Tedessa was very upset at this and said the devil didn't like perfume, but she should have put it on her forehead, that drinking it fed the devil. And she was getting worse, and Tedessa said, "Do something, Jean." Well, the Lutheran Church taught me a lot in confirmation, but how to exorcise demons just wasn't one of them. I really didn't know what to do, but I went up to her, put a hand on either side of her head, and said, "In the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, I command you to come out of this woman." With that, she went into violent convulsions. She frothed at the mouth, although she didn't have a history of epilepsy. And in a short time, she sprang up, this quiet, timid little person, thrust us all out of the way. She tossed me against the wall, ran out of the room, out of the house, out of the gate of the fence. And I said to Tedessa, "Where is she going?" And he said, "She's going to the forest to dance with the other demon-possessed people." He said, "She'll be back in a day or two, and then she'll sleep for 48 hours, and she'll be all right." And I said, "Oh, would you take me? I'd like to see this." And he said, "Oh, no." He said, "If you went, you would become possessed by devils." He said, I wouldn't take you." The main road that runs through Ethiopia that I told you about, there's very little traffic on it, because they just simply don't have rolling stock in that country, which is one of the reasons it's so difficult for us to get our food to them that we're sending because of the droughts. And you see, whenever possible, they use animals. When they run out of animals, they use women. That is a woman underneath that enormous load of eucalyptus. The great forests of Ethiopia have long since been denuded between the people themselves and the Arabs coming over and cutting. Someone fortunately planted eucalyptus in the country, and that does grow prolifically and is quite hardy. And that's all they have in the way of wood, which is one reason you don't see much paper. They use it for fuel. They use some of it when they can for building. And everywhere you go, you see the eucalyptus growing. I got on a bus after a few days and started a trip. This is the second largest city in Ethiopia, called Dessie. And you can see how very primitive it is. Even the main street is not paved. And again, it shows that all the money went into Addis. The entire town looked as if it was in the middle of construction, and I found that to be true everywhere once you got outside of Addis. All the buildings had scaffolding around them, and everything was in a state of disrepair. My two guides in Dessie, I asked what I could send them from the States, and they explained that they wanted books on family life. And I didn't quite understand what they meant. And after probing a bit, I discovered what they wanted was books on sex. Mid-Victorians or Ethiopians are extremely mid-Victorian. The children are never taught about sex in school. Their parents don't discuss it with them. And they had heard that in the West you could find things like that. So they wanted me to send them some. Everywhere the bus stopped, the children met it, and with sugar cane. That is the only sweet they have in the country, and they would sell that, and you'd ride along on the bus sucking on it as if it were an all-day sucker or something. I finally got off the bus at a place called Waldia. What you're looking at is the front part of the hospital that the Lutherans had built there. This is the clinic where the day patients came in. Health care in Ethiopia is very poor. There's so much superstition. The priests are the rulers of the villages. And for instance, when a woman is going to be delivered of a child, if she has difficulty, a breech birth, something like that, the priest will not let her leave the village until the sun has set for 3 days. By the time they got people, women, into this hospital, some of them had been bent over logs and jumped up and down on. There would be a hand protruding that all the skin was pulled off of where they tried to pull the child out. They usually lost the baby, and quite often they lost the mother also. Otto Berhe was head of the Lutheran Church in Ethiopia. He too is a Tigray. And he must have seen the handwriting on the wall when the communists came in, because very shortly after the takeover, he left the church and went into the import-export business. Ruby was a nurse there from Texas, and she grew her own garden, and she had green salads. And I hadn't been able to eat a green salad for about 5 months. I don't know when anything tasted so good. I didn't eat anything else the whole time I was at Waldea. They told me about the possibility of getting a mule to go with a mule train to go to Lalibela. And I had long wanted to see Lalibela. The story behind it is that one of the queens who succeeded the Queen of Sheba, oh, I might add, the Queen of Sheba, well, then this is biblical. She went to visit the great ruler of the land in that time, who was King Solomon. And on her return trip from the Holy Land, she was delivered of a son, Menelik I. And then Ethiopian tradition has it, we're leaving the Bible now and going somewhere else. When Menelik was 15, he wanted to see his father, so he journeyed to the Holy Land. Legend has it that King Solomon gave him the Ark of the Covenant and the tablets of the Ten Commandments of Moses, and he returned with those, and that they are in a church in Asmara. Only one or two of the priests is privileged to see it. All but the educated of Ethiopia believe that this is most certainly true. At any rate, one of the descendants of the Queen of Sheba became a Muslim, and she started persecuting the Christians. So a man named Lalibela gathered up the remaining Christians and struck out across country to escape the persecution. He went to probably one of the wildest and most desolate parts of Ethiopia, and there he established a city. One of the first things they did was to dig down through the tops of the hills, and it was solid granite underneath, which is soft at first and then hardens when it's exposed to the air. And there he built a town and lived, and I wanted to see these churches of Lalibela. So the next day I got on a mule. That was quite another story. No one could speak English, and I thought, well, I should take the man who owned the mules to the police station so that somebody would know where I was. And so that he would know they knew. So the police wrote out this long agreement in Amharic, and I signed my name, and he put his X, and then the police folded the paper and handed it to him. And I thought, oh, well, I couldn't read it anyway. So at the first couple of days of the mule trip, two geology students from Liverpool joined us. But after that, I didn't have anybody to talk to but the mule, and I have to admit that I did end up talking to him. Some of the desolation of the country that we passed through, we were climbing constantly, so even though Addis is high, we were climbing even higher. If you can imagine trying to wrest a living from a land like this. You can see the primitive method of farming, the oxen with the crooked tree as the plow, and the land was very stony. They constantly had to take the stones out and get them out of the field. Again, you see some of the desolation. You can imagine This was a good year. 2 years later, they had a four-year drought. You could imagine what it did to people who lived in this area. This was my first hotel, and my host, it was just a room, sort of a tavern, really, and the only place to sleep was a mud and wattle bench that was built into the wall, and everybody in the village had to come and look at this strange Ferengi, which is the Amharic word for white woman, and no one could talk, so they just sat and stared at me. Well, I'd been on the mule for 11 and a half hours. All I wanted to do was roll out my bedroll and get some sleep. But they sat there till about 10 o'clock at night, and it was so late and I was so tired, I saw the wall moving behind their heads as they sat on this bench that I was to sleep on. And I thought, my goodness, I must be tired when the walls start moving. So I got into my bedroll and was almost asleep, and all of a sudden I felt as if I'd been shot. And I jumped out of the bedroll and got my flashlight and looked around, and here was a rusty red beetle about a quarter of an inch long. That is the famous Ethiopian bedbug. They thrive on DDT. And white people are so allergic to them that the third day I was on the mule, one bite makes all the rest of the bites swell up into great big hives. The bedbugs are so prolific in Ethiopia that even Selassie's daughter, the princess, always liked to stay with the Christian missionaries when she traveled, because she said that was the only place she could sleep without finding the bedbug. My second night's lodging, I really went from bad to worse. That's what the little villages look like as you pass by. This was my third night's lodging. Here, all I had was a pile of skins. The people love their children. Their infant mortality rate is so high, and even the fathers are seen carrying them and playing with them, which I did not see anywhere else in Africa. This little boy, I don't know if you can see it, but his eyelashes were ringed with flies, just solid. And what happens here is the flies carry infection, the eyes become infected, and then when they heal, scar tissue forms. It pulls the lashes in on the eyeball, and it blinds the children. And much as they love their children, they are just too poor to support a non-productive member in the tribe. And so they allow them to simply waste away, even though they really are very fond of them. I did so want to try to explain to the mother to just keep the little boy's eyes clean and keep the flies away, but there was no way that we had of communicating. The guide insisted on taking this picture. I want you to know I am not laughing sitting on that rock. That's a grimace. We were so far back by this time that the people were not wearing cloth. They were wearing animal skins. This is a little shepherd boy who had his flock of sheep back in the wilderness. In order to get their grain into town, the farmers stuff it into these goat skins and leave it by the side of the road, and as the mule train comes by, they pick it up and take it to market for him. Even though he's scrambling to get out of the way, I was glad I got this shot because he's wearing the national Ethiopian ethnic dress for men. As we climbed even higher, I said to the guide, "Ethiopia, this, or Lalibela this way, Lalibela this way." He said, Lalibela, that way. And I thought, my goodness, there is no way that that mule and I are going to get over that mountain. But we did. The little fellow would get to a ledge almost chest high. He'd take a deep breath. He'd put one foot up, another foot up, and then gather his haunches and make the leap. I wasn't sure he'd last, and I sort of wondered how much one small Ethiopian mule would cost. But as you see, we did make it. The pass was over the clouds, and it was crisscrossed with paths. It was one of the main arteries of the people. That's our mule drivers. The one on the left is carrying my backpack and bedroll. They also sell their fermented drink up here. You don't dare drink the water, so everyone drinks this sort of Ethiopian beer, and they were selling it in gourds up at the top of this pass. Finally arrived in Lalibela. It's a very high town, and looking out over it, this is the terrain that you see. This man is a weaver. Women are never allowed to touch the loom. They can card and spin the cotton and the wool, but the men set the loom up every morning. They have a hole in the ground that they sit in, and their feet operate the pedals. There is so little water in Lalibela that there is simply not enough water to wash clothes. That's a luxury they don't have. So the robe this man is wearing was, in the beginning, the same color as the cloth that he's weaving. Lalibela had another distinction of having being the only village that had two-story apartments. One family lived in the second story here, another family in the lower floor. Now we come to one of the major churches of Lalibela. This is the Church of St. George, and you can see how it is carved right down through the top of the mountain. They would carve the outside, dig away a trench around it, very narrow, which made them awfully difficult to photograph. And then they would cut a window and bring all the rubble from inside out through that window. These are two-story churches. They are used to worship in today. And the worship services, you think you've stepped back in time, clear into AD, the priests chant, they wear long robes, they carry staves that have metal on the bottom, and they dance in circles and strike the stone floors with their staves, and it's a very eerie kind of sound. The churches, of course, one reason they were built this way is that they were fortresses. So the only way to get into this church is to enter this narrow passageway through this tunnel. There was room for only one at a time. So you can imagine that it would be very difficult for an army to get in here and get at the people who were barricaded. Inside that opening on the left of the photo is where you come out. And again, room for only one person at a time. You see on the right the adze marks. These were all carved with very old stone tools. This goes back to the 1500s when these churches were built. And that is the cross of Lalibela. It has a distinctive shape, and always there is the cloth draped through the lower part of the cross. And you can see the man there is wearing a sheepskin for clothing. The old olive door, which shows you at one time there were olive groves in Ethiopia, although I didn't see any on my trip. I doubt if they're still there. You see the cross on the right, carved out of the rock. And again, the priest in his priestly robes. Each window was carved with a Christian motif, and each one was different. This is the priest teaching the children the ancient language of Guise. They have a choice at a certain age. The parents either send them to the priestess school, as they call it, or if there is a school available, they send them to learn reading and writing in Amharic. But the schools were very far and few between, and most children were educated in Guise and nothing else. The murals in the churches were painted directly on the walls. This is one of the three wise men, which I particularly like. All of the Ethiopian paintings have the distinctive eyes. You can pick them out of any Christian art for that reason. And one of the priests went in, and just lying on the floor, thank goodness it's not humid up there, it's much like Holden Village as far as being dry is concerned, and these priceless books just lying on the floor, he brought this one out to show me what their Bibles look like. And again, you see the eyes in the illustration, and then the language of Guise printed on the right. Another church you got to through this, by this very narrow limestone path, but it was utterly impossible to get a photo of it. And then underneath that, through a secret passage, was yet another church. They were really hidden. You had to be shown where they were. We came out partway from Lalibela, and then we came to a road. And this is where the trucks could get to, as close as they could get to the town. I spent the night here, and then the next day caught a ride on the back of a big vegetable truck and rode down to the highway with the vegetables. That's what the trip looked like. And then I caught a bus to go back to Addis Ababa, but on the way I went through a town where they were having the Danakil market. So I got off the bus and went to the market. These are the Danakil tribes who live in the Danakil desert, and they make their living by going way out into the desert and cutting salt. And then they load the salt on these camels, and they bring it back to the edge of a town and trade it for staples and other goods that they don't have. They are a nomadic, very primitive people. They also are Muslim. You can tell by the way the women have the black head cover. I talked to the head of this tribe, who could speak a little English, and asked if I could travel with them, and he agreed to let me. I had to run to the bank in town and get Ethiopian dimes. They would take no other currency, and I got my bills changed into dimes, which aren't worth very much. The women are bare from the waist up, and they have long hair, and they wear long skirts. The men have short hair, and they wear trousers and shirts, white shirts usually. You can see the cooking pot strapped to the camel. Their belongings are very few, because they constantly have to carry them with them. But anyhow, the women, then I guess word spread very quickly that this strange Ferengi was going to be walking with them for a while. And the women formed a sort of group led by a little gray-headed woman bent over with a cane. and they came toward me. Well, I knew the Danakils had a reputation for being very fierce. A generation ago, any time they met a stranger, they cut him into pieces, and the members of the tribe put the pieces on their spears and carried them around. So I started backing up, and I backed up into a camel and couldn't go any further. And then finally the little gray-haired lady reached out and felt all over the front of me. And then she turned around to the group of women, and even though I couldn't understand the language, I could hear her saying, "I told you it was a woman, I told you so." But they had to be sure, and they weren't until they felt. They're sitting here weaving baskets. They weave them so well that they will even hold water. But I thought, as I stood looking at this scene, the leader asked me not to take any pictures on the trip because his people really didn't like it. And I could see that. You know, I'd hate to have somebody from Africa come over and start photographing me as being some sort of curiosity. So I could see why they didn't like it. But I thought, as I stood looking at this scene, that probably it hasn't changed in 5,000 years. You really had a sense of stepping back in time. And then after a few days in Addis, I will have to admit, I could take the rugged life for a while, but then I like the creature comforts. So I checked into the Filoa. I had a steam bath, I had a massage, I had hot water, and I had a bed. This is Tadessa and his sister. Again, you can see how much lighter skinned they are than their friend on the left. I was fortunate in the day that I departed Addis, because the very plane I had been on the following day blew up, exploded on the tarmac, and everyone in it was killed. Very little water. They depended primarily on the two rains, the spring rain and the fall rain. Very little precipitation other than that. And you see, they never learned, and of course Selassie never made any effort to dam the rivers, to build reservoirs, to catch the water. They only knew how to use what came. I will say I'm quite sure that all these people I photographed on this trip are now dead. I might add, too, that this was not all drought, this tremendous death and suffering there. Ethiopia is in the middle of a civil war. The Eritreans and the Tigrays are against the communist government, and so the government is preventing their getting food. They simply are not allowing it to get to them, except in very rare instances. Food is piled up on the docks, at the ports, and they're even selling this food that many of us are sending to the Egyptians, putting the money in their pocket. We have left only, all the churches are closed. They did leave the seminary. We have one couple there, the Dietzes. They were written up a couple of weeks ago in the Lutheran Herald, and they keep a very low profile. They are allowed to stay. The multi-million-dollar broadcasting station that the Lutheran Church built, which was broadcast in 16 languages, it even went to China. The Bible read at dictation speed with no commentary. Was not jammed. It was allowed to get through. The communists have taken over that broadcasting station and are using it now for propaganda. I was in correspondence with him and his sister for about 10 years, and suddenly all letters stopped. I have been able to get no trace of him. I'm sure he's either was drafted for the army and killed, or he is in prison in incognito. Well, if there's nothing further, good night, and thank you so much for your patience.